Well, good morning, everybody. Today we will be starting a new series in the book of Leviticus, as we just heard by the reading. Out of curiosity, has anybody ever heard a sermon series on the book of Leviticus before? Awesome. That's kind of what I figured. Out of the books in the Old Testament, this is probably one of everybody's least favorite. And we don't really like to read it, let alone even talk about it. So again, I'm not shocked that nobody's really ever heard a sermon series on it. I know they exist. I know actually one of the churches near us, Eden, Pastor Dan, did a series on Leviticus, I think last year or the year before. It was pretty recently. But this book, to us, is basically just full of a bunch of sacrificial and legal stuff that doesn't really seem to apply to us anymore or really even make sense when we read through it. I wanted to do this series for quite a few reasons, but one of the main reasons is actually why we're doing it as the first series of this year. Because how many of you have ever started or tried the whole read the Bible in a year thing and go along pretty well until you get to this book and then it just dies? I would be lying, honestly, if I said I have never done that myself multiple times. But that's kind of just what seems to happen when we get to this book, because what happens when you start reading the book at the beginning of the year, like Genesis is awesome, you got lots of stories, you got creation, you got like people that you're following, it's all narrative, some genealogy in there kind of slow you down, but you just basically skip those and move on, and then you go to Exodus and like, okay, this is still pretty cool, we got lots of stories, and then to the end of it, and it's like the instructions for the tabernacle, and then they build the tabernacle, and they basically, it's the same exact words as when they give the instructions for the tabernacle, and then you flip the page and Leviticus starts, and you're like, oh, this reads just like the end of Exodus. All right, I'm done. I mean, that's honestly, again, I've done that myself. It's very easy to do, and it's one of the biggest reasons for that is because we look at all this stuff, and we're like, I don't care. Like, none of this really seems to apply. Half of this is like, I don't even understand what's going on. It seems really gory. Like, what am I supposed to do with all this? Well, my goal with this series is to equip us with some tools to understand a lot of the big things that are happening in this book, and also to help click at least some of the small stuff together too. And with that goal in mind, I will not be covering every verse, and I know a lot of us are like, oh, thank God. So I won't be going through like super deep every single verse, which also means, though, that I will probably miss things that you might be curious about. So as we go through the series, keep notes, write down questions you might have. I will be doing a Q&A at the end. And as we look to understand and apply what we find, I will also be looking at Hebrews and other New Testament texts and what the New Testament authors do with the imagery that is used throughout Leviticus. Hebrews consistently, and like there's just whole sections that are just straight up quoted from the Old Testament, specifically Leviticus, which is ironic because Leviticus and Hebrews are like the Old Testament and the New Testament books that we really just ignore because they just, like, there's so much there that we're just like, whatever. So my goal with this series is actually to help us not only understand Leviticus, but also understand Hebrews and some of the other stuff that is going on in the New Testament and how they're using this Old Testament imagery and the sacrificial system and all the ritual laws and stuff like that. Because the better we understand Leviticus, the better we understand the Old Testament, the better we understand the New Testament. So that's kind of a major goal for this. So you will notice as we go that I do spend actually quite a bit of time in Hebrews and a couple other books. We'll talk about 1 Peter a little bit today. So hopefully throughout this, we will all be equipped to understand these books better so that next time we read them, hopefully they make a bit more sense and they're a bit more interesting. If I'm really lucky, you might actually even enjoy this book like I've learned to do through studying it. I know that's asking a lot, but we'll see. Before we start digging into Leviticus, we need to see how the book as a whole fits into the story of the Bible. Genesis 1 through 2 opens with creation and Adam and Eve in the presence of God, enjoying fellowship with him. Then in chapter 3, you have the fall, or the entrance of sin into the world, and Adam and Eve are expelled from the presence of God. The effects of sin and the fall continue to corrupt mankind until in chapter 6 through 9, God sends a flood to wipe out everybody except for the faithful Noah and his family. In chapter 9, however, by the end of it, we see that the effects of sin and the curse are even in Noah's children. By chapter 11, all of Noah's descendants disobey God's mandate to multiply and spread throughout the earth and instead gather in one place to make their own temple and make a name for themselves. God puts an end to this by confusing their language and scattering them, causing them to actually do the thing that he said they were supposed to do. We have quickly gone from two people in God's presence, his created Eden temple, who were expelled, to a lot of people creating their own temple for their own purposes and being expelled. In chapter 12, we see God call out of all the now scattered people one couple, Abram and Sarai, to be his covenant people. In contrast to the people trying to make a name for themselves at Babel, God promises to make a name for Abraham and his descendants. He even changes Abram's name to Abraham, which means father of a multitude. We see God actively present and involved in Abraham's life throughout the next few chapters, and Abraham is given the promise that God will give him the land of Canaan and be present with his descendants there. In the rest of the book, we see his descendants as they await fulfillment of the promise through Isaac and then through Jacob, and then they are forced to go to the land of Egypt, where they are actually in bondage for 400 years, just as God had promised back in Genesis 15, but also, just as God promised, they are delivered from Egypt with great possessions and begin the journey back to the promised land. Along the way, they stop at Mount Sinai, where God makes a covenant with the people and gives them laws to follow as his people. They agree to follow the laws and be in covenant with God, but when Moses is gone for a long time getting all the laws from God, the people have Aaron make a golden calf and worship it. They default back to the form of worship that they had known in Egypt. They may even think that they are worshiping God in this way, but he is angry with them because they are trying to worship him on their own terms for their own purposes and in forms that he did not command. Because of this sin, God threatens to kill all the people except Moses. But after Moses' intercession, he instead sends a plague among the people. Notice that this episode in Exodus, the golden calf incident, comes immediately after the instructions from God to build the tabernacle and kind of interrupt the flow of the narrative. You'd think you have the instructions to build the tabernacle and then they build the tabernacle. Instead, you have the instructions to build the tabernacle and then this golden calf thing happens and then they build the tabernacle later after a few things happen in there. And also, during this whole golden calf thing, it is clarified that at this time, because of the golden calf thing, God only met with Moses on Mount Sinai and in the tent of meeting, which it is very clearly specified was outside of the camp at this time. And God just straight up says that's for the people's own protection, because if I go in their midst, I'm going to kill them. And then starting in chapter 33, God then says that the people can still go to the promised land and he will clear the way for them, but he won't go with them so that he doesn't kill them for being stubborn. Through Moses' intercession again, however, God renews the covenant and promises to be with the people as they go. In chapter 35, Moses gives the people the instructions he received for the building of the tabernacle so that the tent of meeting can be inside the camp. Exodus ends with the completion of the tabernacle complex and the resting of the presence of God within the camp. At the very end of the book, we read, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, for the cloud of the Lord was on their tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys." The presence, the glory of God, was in the camp. Leviticus seeks to answer the question that should be on everybody's mind. Now what? The presence, the glory of God is in the midst of the people that he had just threatened to exterminate because of their stubbornness and who he was specifically meeting outside of the camp and didn't even want to go with them so that he didn't kill them. And now his presence is in their midst. So Leviticus is answering, how is that going to work so that the people don't die? And this answer comes in the form of a bunch of sacrifices, rituals, ceremonies, and laws that really to us don't appear to make much sense, and we basically skip when we do the Bible reading. This is like big climactic thing where it's like, okay, he's in the midst of the people, now what? And then we're like, oh, that's boring, skip. In their own context, though, these things make a lot of sense. And they are actually instructive in two key ways. First, most Israelites did not have constant access to any written scripture. It is probable that Moses did not write all of the Pentateuch until near the end of his life. Even if he did, and you actually see places specified, even actually here in Exodus and Leviticus, that he did write some of it down. He wrote the Book of the Covenant, which is like part of the Pentateuch. So he did write some down, but even if he did write some or a lot of it, whatever, during his life, there's only going to be like one copy or maybe a few copies. So it's not like us now where we all have probably multiple Bibles in our house. That just wasn't how it was back then. In fact, you didn't even have books. You usually had like tablets that were heavy or like big scrolls that the priests had. There just wasn't, there weren't that many copies going around at that time, essentially. So a lot of what we see here going on, the sacrificial system, the appearance of the tabernacle, the practical outplaying of everyday life through the ritual laws and the holiness laws that we'll get to later, that was the Bible for the people. It was a visual instruction manual for the people to teach them about God. Second, Israel was not the only nation with a sacrificial system. A lot of times we read all this stuff, or more likely skip over all of this stuff, and forget that this did not happen in isolation. So this was not only instructional in that it is a visual teaching to the people, but it's also instructional in that, yes, this sacrificial system, not going to lie, is actually very similar to what was happening in a lot of other nations. In fact, if a nation didn't have a sacrificial system at that time for their god, they were considered a defective nation. Like, what is wrong with you? You don't honor your god? But the sacrificial system and the ritual laws and everything that God gives to the people are different in many ways from the systems of those nations around them. And those differences are very instructive to help the people understand who God is, who their God is, who the God is, and how he wants to be worshipped and how he relates to people and what are his attributes. The differences in the Israel, in God's sacrificial system and his laws that he gives the people are very instructive in how God is the God. So those are two key things that I'm going to be focusing on as we look through this book. How the sacrificial system visually teaches the people and how the differences in the system between what God tells people to do and what is done in the nations around them, how those two things teach the people and teach us. So today we'll be looking at chapter 1. This is the first of 7 chapters about sacrifices. And the book, by the way, can generally be broken down into a few different sections. Chapters 1 through 7, you have types of sacrifices. Then you have the ceremonial founding of the ritual system in 8 through 10. You have laws and ceremonies for ritual purity in 11 through 16. Covenant behavior in the last chapter, 17 to 27, which this covenant behavior includes things like community laws, priestly criteria, sacred calendar, economic laws, and also ends with the blessings and cursings. So today, chapter 1 is the first of 7 chapters about sacrifices. As we work through these sacrifices, my goal is to help us understand what the sacrifices are, what each sacrifice is in its context, and the various elements of the sacrifice and what they are meant to teach us, or more correctly, teach the Israelites, and then we can learn through that. And then also to see how this understanding helps us to make sense of how the New Testament authors pick up and use this imagery as they talk about salvation, the church, and our relationship to God through Christ. This first offering is the burnt offering. It is one of the offerings that the priests had to offer at the beginning and end of every day, and we see here that it can also be offered voluntarily by anybody who wishes to. The first question we ought to answer is, what is the purpose? Why this offering? What is this offering for? Luckily, the answer to this question is already given to us at the end of verse 3. So we'll read verse 3. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. Now, a couple notes here about translation. First, the word offering. Throughout Leviticus, you'll notice that they use offering and sacrifice. There is actually a difference. I'm not going to spend much time on this because at the end, semantically, it doesn't really matter all that much. But technically speaking, an offering is something that the whole animal is burnt. Sacrifice is something that somebody eats part of. That's really all that's going on there with the difference. And then also, depending on your translation, when it says entrance to the tent of meeting, you might have entrance to the tabernacle. What you want to keep in mind is that the tabernacle is a complex that includes the tent of meeting. So the two terms are used interchangeably, basically, because the tent of meeting basically was a stand-in for sacred space, where God is. So the entrance to the tent of meeting, think about somebody basically coming to the tabernacle complex, and then you had the tent of meeting inside of it, and then on the way to the tent of meeting, you had the altar. There's other stuff there, but we're not going to get there right now. So basically, they came to the tabernacle complex, and they're like, I want to offer an offering. And this is a burnt offering. So then you go to the altar, and then the tent of meeting is in front of the altar, farther into the temple complex. So just kind of help you orient to what's going on here. But anyways, getting back to the purpose of this sacrifice, what it says here is that he may be accepted before the Lord. Now, we immediately may assume that this acceptance is talking about forgiveness of sins. But actually, that is us bringing something into the text that's not actually there. And a lot of times what happens with as we read through Leviticus, there's a lot of stuff that, again, we usually just skip over, and we tend to combine a lot of it and bring things from other places in Leviticus into this place in Leviticus, and it's like, well, you got to let it all be what it is on its own terms first. Don't just start combining stuff, which is what we do, because we, honestly, myself included, until I studied for this, we don't study Leviticus that much. That's why this stuff happens. It's not like we're like trying to like contort the text or anything like that. We just don't know it that well. So anyways, that's us usually bringing something into the text. If you read through the rest of the chapter, there is literally nothing mentioned anywhere about anything this person has done wrong. There isn't a moral issue at stake here. There are other places in Leviticus that it makes it very clear that there are things going on. So again, let's not bring those into here. We'll get to those later. There is atonement language, but that is also not talking about sin, and I'll get there in a few minutes. The idea of forgiveness of sin also doesn't match the use of this offering elsewhere in the Bible. This burnt offering is the type of offering that Noah offered after he got off of the ark. It is used at the beginning in renewals of covenants. It is often used by Samuel to gain an audience with God to seek guidance. And it was the type of offering that Elijah made in his contest with the prophets of Baal. This offering is often seen also paired with other types of offerings or ceremonies, where it almost appears as kind of like the warm-up to those other things. A good way to understand what is going on with this offering is to understand it as a gift to God from somebody seeking to enter his presence or sacred space. By bringing a gift, the offerer is hoping to be accepted onto sacred space and spend some time with God and not be killed while doing so. This is also why the entire offering is burnt. It is completely for God. This type of offering is similar to how we sometimes bring a small gift to somebody's house when they invite us over. It is often used to initiate a time of prayer or have the priest pray for the person, or as mentioned before, to initiate some form of offering, sacrifice, or ceremony. So now that we know the purpose of the offering, let's walk through some of the details. The first thing we see is the clarification that he shall offer a male without blemish. So a couple things to note here. First, males are used because they are more valuable but also more expendable. Honestly, you don't need as many males as females to sustain a herd. So it's actually just, there's a practical aspect to what's going on there. So that's honestly the majority of the reason for why that's used. Without blemish, bringing a defective animal was an insult, or basically seen, not just in the sacrificial system of Israel, but in like every nation, to bring a defective animal to a god was to insult that god, which is probably not a great thing to do if you're seeking an audience with that god. So that's why you have a male without blemish. And then the next thing you see is in verse 4, lay his hand on the head. And let's read verse 4. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make an atonement for him. I don't know how many translations we have represented here, but you will notice that there is quite a bit of variance with how this verse is translated. There's a lot of stuff going on here culturally, semantically, and with the exact words that are happening here, so I'm going to try to break it all down for us. This is also really the start of where we bring some ideas into the text that aren't actually there. This act, this laying of the hand on the head, is simply a person symbolically dedicating this particular animal for sacred use as a sacrificial victim, and putting their personal signature on the animal. If you will, it's basically like them signing the animal and saying, this is from me. And why they would do that is because the priest, if you'll keep following the wording, the priest is the one that offers the animal. But basically it's the person saying, yes, the priest is doing it, but this is from me. I am giving this gift to God. Now God obviously knows that, so it's symbolic. And it's, again, you got to think of the fact that this whole system is teaching the people. So a lot of what's going on is symbolic. So it's a reminder to the person that I am here giving a gift to God, which, by the way, I think we probably mentioned this in a ton of other places, but like your herds and flocks were a more accurate representation of somebody's wealth than money. Like for us, it's how much money you have in your bank account, sometimes how big your house is or your nicer cars, whatever. But like back then, it's like how many animals you have. So they are sacrificing something of their own possessions to come be with God. So the laying on of hands, again, symbolizes that this particular animal is now being used for a sacred use of a sacrifice, and that it comes from the person. Now, this may be different than what you've heard before. It actually is slightly different than how it is used elsewhere in Leviticus. So again, we got to avoid bringing other parts of Leviticus into here. We got to let each thing be itself. And at face value, too, it does seem to be contradicted by the rest of the verse, but let's keep going and see what's really going on here. And why I say it seems to be contradicted is that the next thing that you run into is this atonement word. It says that he may be, verse 4, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering that it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. And at face value, this seems to contradict what I just said about the whole laying of hands just designating this animal is for sacrifice and that this is from me. It seems to indicate there's actually more going on there. And the translation choice of the word atonement is understandable in light of how this imagery is picked up in the New Testament. So I'm not going to say there's nothing going on there, but what I'm going to say is let's look at the original context first, and then we'll get there. Because this translation choice is a little bit misleading when we're trying to understand what's literally going on in the original context. What's happening with the translation is similar to, back to my Good Shepherd series when I was talking about Psalm 23, it's similar to the choice of translation in Psalm 23:3 when it says, he restores my soul. A more literal translation of Psalm 23:3 would simply be, he brings me back. Because there's a lot of shepherding imagery going on. The words being used there are, if you just like translate them as what they actually are, it's he brings me back, which is because it's talking about like the sheep goes away and then he comes back, he leads me on the right path. And what we have translated in Psalms is he restores my soul and he leads me on the path of righteousness, which actually, honestly, what's going on with the translation there is that the translators are actually giving you a commentary and basically telling you what David is talking about spiritually. Because the words themselves, if you translate the Hebrew literally, is actually just talking about sheep. But understandably, and honestly rightly so, the translators realize that David is not talking about sheep. He is and he isn't. So their translation is actually a commentary to help you get to what David is actually talking about. So again, the atonement language, especially when we flash forward to the New Testament and everything, like it's understandable why we get here and why we have translation choices that are like this. But I would argue we should first let the Old Testament be what it is, and then we can work from there to get to how it's used later. So the word that's being translated here as atonement has more to do with the idea of removing ritual impurity and being protected from God's wrath. It would be better to use a word like purification, or honestly better yet, decontamination. This word is often used in relation to inanimate objects, which again should point us to the fact that technically speaking, literally, there usually isn't a moral thing going on, because this word you often atone for inanimate objects. In Exodus 29:36-37, they had to make atonement for the altar in inanimate object and consecrate it every day. In Exodus 30:12, the same exact word is used when the census is taken, and each person 20 years and up has to give half a shekel as an atonement for their lives so that God doesn't send a plague. In Leviticus 14, someone being declared clean of a skin disease has to make atonement before the Lord. So the idea of purification and decontamination is much more in mind here. And this is further evidenced if you continue to follow the wording in verse 5. So reading verse 5, it says, then he shall kill the bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So again, this idea of purification and decontamination is further evidenced when we pay attention to where the blood is applied. Because when we're bringing in New Testament understanding, what we think when we read the burnt offering and when we just kind of bring our New Testament back into it, we're like, okay, so the person lays their hands on, it makes atonement, and then the blood is sprinkled on them. That's actually not what happens. The blood is sprinkled, or actually in this case thrown, on the sides of the altar, not the person. The sprinkling or throwing of blood is an act of purification and consecration. It purifies something of impurities and consecrates it to the Lord. Another way to say this is that the blood purges something of ritual, not moral, pollution. The vast majority of the time in the sacrificial system, what this means in practice is that the altar or something in the temple complex is being decontaminated from the presence of somebody other than God. In other words, somebody other than God has entered sacred space, God's space. And it's not bad to be human, it's just you are not God. So in order for you to be on sacred space has to be cleansed of the contamination of the fact that you are not God, is now on sacred space. That ritual and not moral impurity is the focus, is seen clearly again in Leviticus 14, where depending on the sacrifice, a liquid mixture that includes blood or just blood and oil is sprinkled or applied to somebody who has just been declared clean of a skin disease. They have been declared decontaminated from ritual impurity. This is not a moral issue, as there is nothing morally wrong with having a skin disease. And we'll get to that elsewhere. There's a lot of things that somebody's actually considered impure or unholy that's just bodily functions. We'll get there. I'm not going to steal the thunder of all those chapters. But again, long story short, this is a ritual focus, not a moral focus. In the Old Covenant sacrifices, the only times the blood is applied to a person was when the person agreed to join the covenant. Sorry, when the people agreed to join the covenant in Exodus 24, when Aaron and his sons and their garments were consecrated to the priesthood in Exodus 29, and when a person is declared clean of a skin disease, as seen in Leviticus 14 and other places. These three instances help us to understand what being sprinkled with the blood of Christ signifies in the new covenant, which is, again, where we're getting to how understanding the original context of the old covenant helps us to understand the new covenant imagery that's being picked up. In 1 Peter, written to the church, the people of the new covenant, in other words, us, we read in chapter 1, verse 2, that we were set apart for obedience to Christ and sprinkled with his blood. And we read this in 1:2. This sounds exactly like how the old covenant was started. The people agreed to obey and live in obedience to God, who they were covenanting themselves to, and then Moses sprinkled them with blood. You have the same exact imagery going on when we enter the new covenant. In 1 Peter 2:5, we also read that we are being built as a spiritual house or a new temple to be a holy priesthood to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Just as the blood was sprinkled on the various parts of the tabernacle complex and on the priests and their garments, Christ's blood is applied to us because we are the new temple and the new priesthood offering spiritual sacrifices every day. In Hebrews 10:22, we read that our hearts have been sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Sprinkling with blood and washing with water were the two major elements of declaring somebody ritually clean from a skin disease. The author of Hebrews is using this ceremony as a metaphor for spiritual cleansing, just as Ezekiel does in Ezekiel 36. If you follow the imagery, then, of what he's picking up on from the Old Covenant, what we see then in Hebrews 10:19-22 is that we can have confidence to enter the Holy of Holies through the curtain that Christ has permanently opened through his sacrifice, and where he now stands as our permanent high priest, having permanently made us ritually clean by the sprinkling of his blood to enter into the presence of God through his mediation. And there's a lot going on right there. So if you could flip real quick to Hebrews chapter 10. And by the way, as we're reading through Leviticus, you may even just want to keep a bookmark in Hebrews, because we'll be going there a lot. So if you go to Hebrews chapter 10 real quick, I'm going to read those verses and then read that statement that I just read again. So Hebrews chapter 10, verses 19-22. It says, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places," read Holy of Holies, "by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain." We'll get to this later, but there's a curtain dividing the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And that, remember, when Christ died, the curtain was torn in two. So there's a lot of imagery being picked up here. "Opened through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Again, sprinkling with blood and washing with water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. We're going to stop there. So again, this imagery here, this is just straight up pulling imagery from the Old Covenant, some of the ceremonies that happened there. So again, if you follow the imagery of what the author of Hebrews is doing, what we see in these verses is that we have confidence to enter the Holy of Holies. And we'll get into later how big of a deal that was in the Old Covenant, the Holy of Holies, literally entered once a year. But we have confidence to enter the Holy of Holies through the curtain that Christ has permanently opened through his sacrifice, and where he now stands as our permanent high priest. The high priest had to keep switching because they kept dying. There wasn't a permanent high priest before. Now Christ is forever the high priest. Having permanently made us ritually clean by the sprinkling of his blood to enter into the presence of God through his mediation. The ritually clean is important. This is picking up a spiritual significance to the Old Covenant ceremony of being declared clean of a skin disease. And when you put that into the Holy of Holies language and how we're able to come in there, and basically what it's saying is, and we'll get to this later, this is just amazing what's happening here. So we'll dig into it later, specifically in Leviticus 16. But what's essentially happening is Christ has permanently opened the curtain that only opened once a year. And he's permanently standing there by the Holy of Holies, which represented God's very presence. And we are declared permanently clean enough to come there and talk to God through the mediation of Christ. Which, if we'll get there, but it took a lot of ceremonial cleansing to get the high priest clean enough to go there. And then he even had to wear a rope and wear bells so that in case he died, they could drag him out. Basically, if the bells stopped ringing too long, they would drag him out because he's probably dead because he did something wrong. He wasn't clean enough. Like, it was a huge deal to be in the Holy of Holies. And we have permanent access to the Holy of Holies. So again, that's just a brief summary of just some of the awesome things that are happening. We'll get to that later in Leviticus 16. But it all starts here. The seeds are planted here of that understanding of what the New Testament authors are doing in as they pick up this Old Covenant imagery. But getting back to other details, you'll notice that there are a few different options for offering, and you read them and they kind of basically all sound the same. And the reason for that is that this was an allowance for people of various incomes and occupations to be able to make this sacrifice. Because some people aren't going to be able to afford a male without blemish, because they might only have one. And in that day, if you have males without blemish, you try to keep some of them so that you can keep a good herd. You don't want all your defective males being the ones that are breeding. You want as good of a herd as possible. So this is an allowance from God to allow for people of various incomes and occupations and however big their herd is. Basically, you bring to me what you're able to bring. I understand that not all of you come from the same backgrounds and not all of you have the same occupation and the same wealth level. So bring to me what you're able to bring. And it just has to fit into one of the categories. And then you also notice this random note about washing the entrails and the legs. Long story short, this was basically to prevent there from being dung on the altar, which was an offensive thing to God. And there's actually more about that later in Leviticus. But that's basically what's happening there. And then the last detail I want to focus on is the term food offering as seen in verses 9, 13, and 17. This is another unfortunate translation that actually contradicts Psalm 50, verses 12 to 13, which states that God does not need food, and blurs the distinction that is actually being made between God and the gods of the other nations. A better translation, and you might even actually, the Pew Bibles have a footnote here about an alternate translation, and there's what I would argue even a better one, but the alternate translation in the ESV is an offering by fire, which is pretty good, but through more contemporary language and ancient language studies, people have actually figured out that probably the best translation is the word gift offering, which actually perfectly falls in line with what I've been arguing is the original context, what's going on with the offering. And the biggest reason for this is that nowhere in Leviticus or elsewhere in the Bible do we see that God needs us to provide him food. And that's actually one of the major differences between this whole system that God gives to the people and the system of other nations around them. A lot of the other nations understood their sacrificial system and that they were actually feeding the gods. And they could actually use that as a bargaining chip against the gods. Because if the gods sent plagues or killed all people, the nation could then turn to that god and be like, hey, if you keep doing this, nobody's going to be feeding you. On the other hand, God you see with the promises and basically the threats that he gives for disobedience, he doesn't need that. He can exile everybody. Like, nobody's going to be at my temple. And he'll be fine. He doesn't need human food. Like, we don't need to sustain God. So that's actually one of the major differences that comes up in the sacrificial system. So in summary, what did this offering teach the Israelites and what does it teach us? For the Israelites, it primarily taught that proximity to God is dangerous. We as people, his creation, are not God. We are not fit to occupy the space that he does unless he accepts us. It also taught that such acceptance comes at a price. A lot of the sacrificial system as a whole is about preparing sacred space for somebody's visit or for preparing it for the presence of God. I didn't dig into the full context of the passages I mentioned before with the atonement language, but the consequences in many of them for not giving God a burnt offering or not giving a ransom in the census was a plague or some form of God's wrath. Basically, the sacrifice taught that if you want to be in God's presence and have fellowship with him, you better do it on his terms, or you could be killed. Which, by the way, is why the whole golden calf thing was such a big deal, because they didn't do it on his terms. They had literally just gotten a bunch of commands that they then went and violated because Moses was taking too long. Literally days after they had agreed to the covenant, they said, okay, this is taking way too long. We're not sure. Now, granted, they might have been a little scared. Like, well, where's our guide? We don't know. Like, Moses, like, God was the God they were claiming, and Moses was the guide for that God. And they're both, to the Israelites, down below the mountain, gone. So they might have been scared and just default back to the forms of worship that they knew. But again, that's against what God had just told them to do. So what they learned real quick through that is that you have to worship God and seek fellowship with him on his terms, not yours. For us, this should cause us to wonder, rejoice, and give glory to God at how radically different and better the new covenant is, just as it said multiple times in Hebrews, in Hebrews 7, 19, 22, 8, 6, 9, 23, 11, 40, and 12, 24. It continuously says the new covenant is better. We now have constant, confident access to God and fellowship with him. Hebrews 4:16 says, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." And Ephesians 3:12 reads, "In whom we have boldness and access with confidence through our faith in him." The ultimate gift for access to God has been given once and for all through the sacrifice of Christ. Because of his sacrifice, we are now made permanently acceptable onto sacred space. And in a surprising turn of events in the new covenant, we are not just made acceptable on sacred space, we become sacred space. After he ascended, Christ sent the Spirit, the very presence of God, to dwell inside every believer, making us his temple. As we saw earlier in 1 Peter and Hebrews, we are the new temple, the new priesthood, under the great high priest, Jesus Christ, who calls us to constantly and boldly enter the Holy of Holies, God's presence, through his mediation. Because everywhere we are, the Spirit is. Sacred space is. And we are called to fellowship with God. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for the glorious truths that we have to learn from this chapter and yet to come in this book. I thank you for all throughout history how you have made a way for man to meet with you, to have fellowship with you. And I thank you that we live in this new covenant time where we have constant access to you. I thank you for what the work of Christ made possible. And I pray that as we think about these truths, as we realize that we are your temple, we are priests under the great high priest, that we are a sacred space, that we would take advantage of that and that we would seek fellowship with you that has now been made radically easier and radically better. And I pray that we wouldn't waste that. I pray this in your name. Amen.